This is Blue Wire.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast, brought to you by the Blue Wire Network. I'm Justin Rowan with my co-host, Carter Rodriguez. Carter, how's it going, buddy?
It's going good. I always used to think about how there was always a little element of surprise if you weren't paying attention when you started our podcast, if we had a guest, because you always go to me first. But if you're watching on twitch.tv/chasedownpod, you would see our dear friend and draft expert, Trevor Magnotti.
Trevor, how's it going, man?
You can see me, you can hear me, and we should all be very thankful for that.
Yes, well, absolutely. Looking like a goddamn snack. I want to thank all the people that are following along on Twitch. This is something we're going to do a little bit more of. I think it's a good idea for mailbags. We're going to do live recording, get instant feedback and questions. Because sometimes when you're listening to a podcast, you want that automatic follow-up there. So if you guys want to follow along on the Twitch, make sure that you're subscribing to it. We'll also tweet out a link from the Chase Down Pod Twitter account. And if you want to make sure you're really not missing it, you can join our Discord chat by leaving a rating, leave a review, subscribe, unsubscribe, and send a copy of that review to chasedownpod@gmail.com. But we're going to start.
I like the way you said a copy of that review, because it almost felt like you wanted us, we were asking them to like mail it to us.
I'm not asking anybody to mail over the border, which is very, very important, because you never know how that's going to go. I want to start off with a question from our Discord, the aforementioned Discord. Soul Slayer had asked, do you think Cam Reddish still can hit his ceiling, given that Duke isn't necessarily the best showcase for a player, or is he just a victim of Coach K? So, Trevor, I'm going to start with you first. Obviously, Cam Reddish now being linked to the Cavs a fair amount. I know we've talked about how the Duke system didn't do Zion or RJ any favors. Do you think there's a little bit of that too with Cam Reddish, or are you just kind of out on him?
I mean, I think there's a little bit to it, just because, I mean, a guy who was so ball dominant in high school, immediately coming in and never getting opportunities to create on ball is probably not ideal for what he wanted going into Duke. But I think the question of like where his ceiling or whether he can reach a ceiling kind of depends on what you think his ceiling is. Because I mean, if you paid attention to him at Duke, it doesn't look like it's very high. Like he cannot dribble. he was one of the worst college finishers of guys his size that we've ever seen.
Right.
Like, you kind of have to really recalibrate what you think he actually can become. And I mean, he may be a little bit better of a ball handler than he was at Duke. He may be a little bit better of a finisher than he was at Duke. But I think the days of like realistically thinking that he's like on par with RJ as a primary creator, those have got to be over. I mean, every year there are guys who are ball dominant high school players who come into college and just clearly cannot match the raised level of intensity and defensive strategy and also size and athleticism. And we, for some reason, think that Reddish is somehow different because he was a top five recruit instead of maybe like a top 10 or 15 recruit. So I think if the question is, do you think that he's going to be like an all-star level talent on offense? I think that there's no way that that is a likely scenario. But I think if you kind of recalibrate and you say, okay, can he be a guy maybe like in the realm of Jarrett Culver, where we think he could eventually become like a really good defensive player who has some offensive ability and can contribute on that end? Yeah, I think there's still a reasonable expectation that he can get there. But it's going to be a lot more probable buy-in than, you know, what we've seen or than what you would initially think. I'm just kind of looking at the reputation that he has going into the draft.
One of the comparisons that you hear for Reddish from fans, and probably less fans and more people are just like hopeful that he ends up being better than what he looks like right now, is a guy like Paul George, who couldn't even make first team all WAC when he was in his last year in college. Similar size profile from the combine. Do you think that's fair if you're kind of looking for a pipe dream, or is it just kind of just not close?
I think that there's like an outside shot of that, but the big thing that I think is keeping Reddish behind a lot of the other guys at the wing in this draft is just he is not a like quick decision maker. He does not read the game and read offenses and defenses as they develop in a way that Paul George did. I mean, George didn't have like a ton of the skills in college, but he was kind of, he was a quick twitch athlete. He could still make a ton of plays on defense. And, you know, he recognized where gaps were going to be on offense and could kind of fill in lanes and was a really good slasher right away. And, you know, he had natural touch, which I think is another thing that Reddish lacks. I think that there's potential that he could get better with that as he gets stronger, and there's potential that he could learn to see the game a little bit better. But that's just something that doesn't get better more often than not. It's something that's a little bit more kind of a natural disposition than we give it credit for, is just that ability to finish at the rim with touch and the ability to just kind of see and process how the game develops at an NBA level is just kind of something that you have, or something that you kind of have to be an elite guy in college to really be able to grow into at the NBA level. So that's my main concern, is that while I think that he's got all the skill in the world, and I think that comparing him to George is, you know, reasonable because of the comparisons of their skill level, I just don't think that he's ever going to reach that level of even being a Paul George level thinker of the game in terms of the processing speed. And that's not the highest bar. So that's a little concerning.
Yeah, my big thing. So I think the thing with Reddish is he looks like what you'd want an NBA player to look like. And I think there's a lot there that was also there with Kevin Knox last year, where he just, hey, he looks like the 3-4 guy that can guard multiple positions. I do think Cam Reddish has better potential defensively. And if I'm playing devil's advocate, I would say maybe he's going to take a leap next season if he stayed in college like Culver or Hunter did. And you'd hope that he kind of has that upside. But I believe in him defensively. I think that there's the potential for him to be a good shooter. Got up over 7 threes a game, only 33%, but maybe better situation or maybe just more attempts that number is going to go up. But I don't see him being that dynamic of a player. Like, I think he's a guy that if he were to fall in the draft, which I don't think he's going to, I think him shooting in open gyms is going to really excite some teams, and I'm kind of hoping it's not the Cavs at 5. But if he were to fall and we're trading up to 13 or something like that, that would be a guy I'd love to target. But at 5, it just doesn't really do it for me. I think there is a natural segue here, though, because there has been some talk about the Knicks really liking Cam Reddish, which actually kind of makes a little bit of sense when you're considering they might add two very ball-dominant players in Kevin Durant and Kyrie. And if the Knicks really want Cam Reddish and the Cavs really want RJ, which a lot of the reports are kind of leaning that way, what would be a reasonable amount to give up if you're moving from that 5 to 3 spot? Like, are you giving up the 26th pick? I just don't know what that type of package would look like, especially when you consider the Knicks probably don't want to take on a lot of salary.
Yeah, that's a really tough question to answer, and I think it has a lot to do with the teams that are up there. I mean, we're dealing with two of the biggest wild card front offices in the league, and that goes for kind of what they would do and who they would value in the draft, and also how they value their own assets. I mean, if you're trying to trade up with the Knicks, you know, it's really a question of what's enticing to them, because they're not a team that I think is, you know, in a position to add like a 26th pick that doesn't really provide a lot of functional value for them, especially if they're chasing Kyrie and Kevin Durant. They're not a team that I think is going to be particularly interested in any of the Cavs' other assets to be able to move up. Right. So
one thing I would say about that, though, Trevor, just to play a little devil's advocate here, I think you're right. I don't really think the Cavs have the pieces to make a trade with the Knicks be particularly workable. But it is worth noting that if they do go out and sign a Kevin Durant and they sign a Kyrie, and especially if they, I guess if you're going to max out your cap in that space, then you do need cheap talent and you need infusions of cost controlled talent. And that is where maybe a late first gets a little more appealing. But unfortunately for the Cavs, I just don't think 26, I feel like that's a little too far down to make it worth their while.
Would you guys, what I want to figure out is what you think fair value would be. Like, if you're, would you say, hey, we'll unprotect the pick from like 5 through 9 next season so that if it's top 4, the Cavs keep the pick. But if it falls 5 to 9, then it goes to the Knicks. If it falls outside the top 10, then it goes to Atlanta. Like, do you think that's good value? Like,
doesn't that feel like it's a little bit, we're going as a franchise, you'd be going out of your way to trade up for a guy who you're pretty sure is going to be good, right? But like, would you rather have that, or would you rather just like have a guy like Jarrett Culver if he makes it to 5?
Well, so that's an interesting question. So I think the part of this hypothetical would be, we know that a lot of these picks are made before they're actually made on TV. That's why Woj is picking 5 picks or selecting 5 picks ahead there.
No, he's insinuating 5 picks ahead.
Right.
Very gently.
He's just great guesses. But let's say the Knicks take RJ at 3, Culver goes 4 to the Lakers, and then the Knicks are on the phone saying, hey, we'd really like to get Reddish. What would it take? I think I would be more willing to unprotect part of that pick the following season if I also had a trade lined up to move up. Like, if I had a JR trade, like what I proposed a little bit earlier on Fear the Sword, where you're trading JR and 26 for James Johnson and 13 to Miami, where you're giving them that salary relief. I think there's a lot of teams in that range. I mean, I've got Pistons bloggers that hit me up saying, hey, trade for us. The Heat bloggers are kind of thinking the same thing. Like, I think a lot of those guys want to trade back and get rid of some salary. So I think there's going to be an opportunity there. So if you can trade up, get your guy, and you're adding another kind of late lotto talent there, at some point you just have you kind of have enough young guys to develop from there, and you're just going to focus your efforts on them. At least that would be my mentality. I think I'd be more willing to part with some of that protection in that scenario.
Yeah, I think that's a really natural segue to that discussion that you just referenced, which is whether the Cavs should try to package JR's contract, which is, of course, eminently movable because you can cut it for next to nothing until July 1st. And the 26th pick to try to move up in the first round. Trevor, is this the kind of draft where you think that's worthwhile? I mean, I see some names in that 26 area, like a Matisse Thybulle, who seem really interesting and seem to have value for the Cavs. Do you think this is the kind of draft that it's worth doing so?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting draft to be in that position, because I think there's a very good chance that if the Cavs stay pat, they're going to end up with somebody that they would have taken at 18 or 20 anyway. There's just a lot of fluidity between how different teams are seeing the way that the prospects kind of shake out in this draft. I mean, you can reference certain guys and where they fall in mocks is a good example of that. Grant Williams of Tennessee, for example, is all over the place. There are some places that you'll see him in the lottery. There are some places where you'll see him down by where the Cavs are picking. Bol Bol, the same thing. You'll see him, you know, at the back end of the top 10, or you might see him out of the first round completely. So there's a lot of fluidity between, I think, where some of these guys are going to go. And that really kind of makes things interesting for a team potentially trying to trade up from the end of that first round into like the middle.
Right.
Because I think that then you're really kind of almost in a position where you might kind of talk yourself into overselling that pick. So maybe you're talking about, you know, you throw like a, or you're talking about maybe throwing a second round pick in, or you're throwing like maybe Ante Zizic now needs to be included in a trade to move up.
Oh, no, not Zizic.
Well,
barking up the wrong tree with this podcast. We don't give it. Yeah.
Well, I'm just trying to like if you're talking about just the relative like risk and value of moving up, I mean, trading all of those assets, a pick plus your valuable expiring contract plus another piece to maybe move up to get a guy that you're not sure whether he is going to be gone maybe like eight picks before. Like, right. I think that's a little bit of a risk.
Is it fair to say that it kind of varies whether you're trading up to like 18 or 12 or 13? Because I think like if you look at mock drafts, like if someone like Brandon Clark, for example, is available at 13 or 12 and you have the opportunity to trade up, like I'm all over that. I'm willing to give up a little bit more because I think that that's a player that's at a different level. And even someone like Jackson Hayes, like I know last time you came on, you compared him to Jared Allen. And like, that would be
just
someone
to get one more look at you.
Yeah. our boy from A Star Is Born. I like, to me, getting one of those guys, I feel like that's before the drop off. That's before the next tier really starts. So if somebody that's kind of there in that third tier for you is still available, I think that's where I would have a willingness to trade that pick and use the JR contract or another expiring.
Where do you see that drop off starting to happen, Trevor? Like I'm trying to figure out, like, is 13 high enough where you still think a player of value is going to be there? Like, kind of how do you break this up? I'm not asking you to tier out your whole draft because I know that'll take 30 minutes, but kind of what are the big lines of demarcation?
So the big lines for me are, I think that there's a drop off between definitely from like probably the fourth or fifth best guys in the draft to like sixth or seventh. And then I think there's another big drop off that comes at around like 12, 13, because like that's where you're getting into like the end of like the Brandon Clark, Jackson Hayes range, and you're starting to get into the beginning of the Nasir Little, Romeo Langford range of like, I think there's going to be like the middle of the first round is kind of the dead zone where you're going to have a lot of these guys who aren't really palatable as like the eighth, ninth, 10th pick. And then also are probably too good to drop past like 14, 15, 16, who are really risky guys. So like, that's kind of what I think makes that ultimate decision for me, is you kind of see how like that range where Atlanta's picking twice and, you know, Minnesota's picking, and you kind of see who's left after that point. And then I think you try to really like hammer maybe that move to up to Detroit spot, or you try to hammer that move to Miami spot.
Yeah.
Because if all the good guys get taken in that spot, which is likely because Atlanta's picking twice, and I think that there's kind of some smarter teams in that range outside of Minnesota who might be drafting Rui Hachimura 11th, which that would be awesome for the Caps.
Nothing makes me happier than how little regard you hold for Rui Hachimura. Japan's great hope, and you just shit on him every time you come on this pod.
He's such a great kid, but he just does not have any skill set that's useful in the NBA, much less on a Timberwolves team. I think that that's what ultimately makes that decision, is like, you're almost kind of like, how many mistakes are made in the back half of the top 10? And that kind of is what makes your decision, because that's the nice thing if you're the Cavs. Like, you don't have to do anything. Like, if it shakes out in a way that you think is advantageous to you, make that move. If you're really worried about the risk of like, or if you're really worried about the risk of somebody being gone that you really like, you know, you can potentially move up, because I think that there's the potential that we could run into a situation where a team in that range pulls the Denver thing in 2017 and they really like one guy and they trade back because they're confident he's going to be there. And the Cavs are the team that can trade up, get their guy. And then, you know, the other team runs the risk. I think that that's something that can happen too. You can bank on maybe like a team really likes like Goga Batadze, the guy from Georgia. And
I have not done enough research.
Well, he's kind of one of the draft's like big, like kind of reputation guys as the combine has gone on. And like maybe a team really banking on him being around at like 20 or at like 25, 26.
Yeah.
And then he ends up going at like 18, 19, and suddenly that team that traded back is put in a bad position. But they thought that they could make that take that risk and the Cavs could benefit from it.
So I think Kobe's going to look like that photo of Joe Dumars with the two phones. Like, I feel like the consensus here is that a lot of this is going to be the Cavs playing it by ear. See who's available at five, and that might change your opinion on whether or not you're trading back. See who's available as we get out of the top 10. If Brandon Clark's there, then maybe you're more aggressive. I also echo Carter's sentiments of I probably haven't done enough research, because as I'm looking at our Twitch questions, I have realized that I have only seen this guy's name in print and I've never attempted to pronounce it. So I want your thoughts on my pronunciation as well as his game for Sekou Doumbouya.
Close, but
no. That's great.
Oh, yeah.
That was mean.
It was. So Sekou Doumbouya,
I would like him more if his last name is pronounced Booyah.
Yeah.
That was closer than you made it seem like it was. But anyway, go ahead.
So he, I think, is very similar to Nasir Little. I think if you had to ask which two prospects are the most similar to each other, my answer would probably either be Culver and DeAndre Hunter, just in terms of kind of like the raw kind of skill sets that they have, and then also Little and Doumbouya, because both of these guys are probably the best at the four, but are probably going to be able to play a little bit of three. Neither can really shoot, but both have kind of some maybe outside shot of becoming shooters. Their best is like athletic slashers. And then they're also like have the body to be a really good defender and have some positive defensive traits, but really don't have a good understanding of like how team defense works at the current level they're at, much less being a good team defender at the NBA level. So
is
I think
they're a little bit bigger than him though. Isn't he like 6'9", 6'10"?
Yeah. So Doumbouya is like 6'9", whereas Little's a little bit shorter, but you counter that Doumbouya is a lot thinner than Little is. Little has a much kind of bigger frame, and Doumbouya also is a little bit more filled out for kind of what his frame is and what his age is. He's the youngest prospect in the draft, which is a positive for him, but he is a little bit more mature physically than we would expect to see a guy his age be. So that's something that's a little bit concerning
to his physical ceiling.
Yeah, I think he's more kind of where he's going to be in terms of like physical development and maybe athletic development than what you would expect, like, you know, like RJ Barrett or Cameron Reddish, who have clear ways that they could get stronger and or faster or more explosive with kind of some body reshaping in like an NBA strength program.
Is he going to be a three or a four for you?
Fuck, I don't know. there's so many of those guys in this draft where it's like, what position do they play? And the answer could be anywhere between the three and the five. You know, as the league continues to get smaller, I think that you have to kind of consider these 6'9", 6'10" guys' ability to play the five. And then also like teams are able to run like four or five guys that are between the heights of like 6'6" and 6'9". So like, I think that there's not really a clear position. I think that he has the skill set of like a small ball four, but I think that he could play anywhere if you put the right guys around him. And that's another point to him too. You know, I think that he's a guy that's going to be positionally versatile. It's just a question of whether he actually like brings enough offensively and is going to be able to be a good enough team defender to actually like contribute consistently to like a winning team.
Is he someone that you could see like who do you see being able to jump? Is this one of those scenarios where we just know who the top three are and maybe really the top five or six? Do we see any surprises in the top five outside of maybe the Cavs jumping up or the Knicks jumping up to snag Reddish when they fall in love with him?
Yeah, I think Reddish is the guy. I think that if you're kind of talking about guys who haven't been talked about as potential top five or six picks, I think Doumbouya is a guy that could be jumping up just because he really showed a lot of development in terms of his his kind of on-ball comfort level as the season went on. He missed a huge chunk of the year with a thumb injury. But when he came back, looked like, you know, a little bit of a different player in terms of his aggressiveness. And I think there are teams that are going to fall in love with that. So he could be a potential riser. I think that Bol Bol and Nasir Little could go anywhere in this draft. Nothing would surprise me outside of maybe the top four for either of those guys. And then, you know, I think that Kobe White also is a guy that could go anywhere. He could be a guy that a team falls in love with, maybe the Lakers or the Cavs, the Suns get in a workout and they really like him. Or he could be one of those guys that you're maybe considering trading back up for at like the 13th, 14th pick. So I think when I talk about the fluidity of how this draft is going to shake out, I think that there's a lot of those guys who are potential top five picks or potential 15, 16 picks, depending on how things shake out. I think there's a scenario where there's going to be a lot of guys who maybe had their sights on being sixth or seventh, eighth picks and are suddenly sitting there at 20 and the Cavs can potentially make a move up.
I want to give a – oh, my goodness, there goes my voice. I want to give a quick shout-out to our guy, Evan, in the Discord, watching live. I'm a little concerned, though, because he's got this bottle of moisturizer dangerously close to his laptop, and I'm really hoping that that is just for self-care and self
– Is this in the Discord?
This is in the Discord. It
oh, my God.
Yeah, he's got the exposed legs
right there. Oh, no.
I mean, I'm just going to assume that that's for taking care of himself in a healthy way. And if you guys want to take care of yourselves in a healthy way, then do we got a product for you? Harry's Razors is helping Blue Wire listeners with a better shaving experience. Go to harrys.com/bluewire to save $10 on a value trial set, which includes a 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, so you don't need that lube, Evan. Rich lathering shave gel, travel blade cover, and you get all of that for just $3. You save $10 on that kit. It's the best deal out there. Carter and I love our Harry's kits. Enough with
I do. It's the best. I don't have any razor burn. I got that nice aloe aftershave that keeps me nice and cool. That was a little extra, but I was fine to pay it. Enough with the cheap razors, Justin. Yeah, I'm talking to you. Just kidding. You're already a Harry's guy. Go try Harry's now. It's just $3 for our loyal listeners. Harry's has fixed shaving. It was broken. They fixed it. They combined a simple, clean design with quality and durable blades at a fair price. Harry's founders were tired of paying for razors that were overpriced and overdesigned. So they just bought a world-class blade factory, as you do, in Germany that's been making quality blades for over 95 years, Justin.
Join Carter, myself, and the 10 million others that have tried Harry's. Claim your trial offer by going to harrys.com/bluewire. All of Harry's blades come with a 100% quality guarantee. If you don't love your shave, let them know, and they'll give you a full refund. Again, make sure you go to harrys.com/bluewire to redeem your razor for just $3. You got no reason not to check it out.
I just want to note, Sweetface Ace just said, why doesn't Trevor do this live read considering he's the only one who shaved in a month? Fair?
No. I clean up. I get rid of that, a little bit of that neared. It's important, sure. But sure.
I was also asked by Elberth, how does it compare to Dr. Carver's shave butter? I prefer the shave gel, honestly.
Dr. Carver's a fraud.
Oh, my God. Hell yeah. Trevor, supporting the brand. He's not even getting paid. So
absolutely. What a guy. See, he's a team player, and I appreciate that. So we talked a little bit about what it would take to trade up and down, what the values would be for those. One thing we haven't touched on, what if we just stay put? What if we're just drafting at five and we got to make a decision there of who's going to be the next crucial piece for the Cleveland Cavaliers renaissance? I personally think we're all kind of in agreement that Jared Culver is our number one option there. I really would like DeAndre Hunter, and anything other than that would kind of bum me out. I'm just not in on Cam Reddish. I'm sure I'd be able to talk myself into him being a good defensive player. and somebody that's going to hit threes for the Cavs. Two things that they do need, but just the Cavs need for some additional playmaking and that type of dynamic player. That's personally why I lean towards Culver. Am I right with lumping you in with me, Trevor?
Yeah, I think that the Cavs, when the lottery shook out and we knew that Cam Reddish was already targeted by the Knicks, and we immediately heard Darius Garland to the Lakers talk. I knew that was like the best case scenario for the Cavs, because they are going to get their pick probably of Jarrett Culver and DeAndre Hunter, who are probably the best two fits for this team and probably the two smartest plays that they can make at that point in the draft. And then, you know, throwing in the outside chance that if both of those teams make those mistakes and they take Reddish and Garland in the top five, then suddenly you've got RJ Barrett, who we wanted all along. So
out of curiosity, why do you say Garland's a mistake for the Lakers?
I was going to ask the same thing.
But I'd like, that's a surprisingly strong take from you for me.
Well, I think that the big thing with him is that he's the third best point guard in this class, and you're taking him in the top four. My thing is that I just don't see a reason why you would take Garland over Coby White, who is a better playmaker, who is a much better defender, who is a similar level of pull-up shooter, I would argue, to Garland, and that's Garland's best skill, and is also 3 inches taller, has a longer wingspan, and just kind of sees the game a little bit better and kind of plays more as like a functional point guard. Like all of that stuff, I think, fits a little bit better than what you want with Garland. I mean, there's a potential fit for him on the Lakers, especially like next to Lonzo Ball and obviously playing with LeBron.
I think he'd be a really good fit there. I think he can give you like a middle class Kyrie type.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, if that's what they were chasing with.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what the thought process is there. I just don't know why, when you see all of these like wings who would fit really well next to LeBron as like smart playmakers who could also save him defensively and, you know, actually give you a guy that could defend the best perimeter player on a given night, which they weren't able to do this year.
Yeah.
I think that like marrying yourself to a 6'2 point guard with a 6'2 wingspan who doesn't really understand how to turn his shot making ability into productive offense, which he has not been able to do at the high school level or in college, yeah, I think is a little bit concerning. So that's kind of why I think he's not the best option for the Lakers. I would much rather see them go after, you know, if RJ's on the table, he's the best fit for them,
right,
in terms of like the playmaker types. But like them taking DeAndre Hunter at four would actually be like a really smart move, because
like, I think that's the fit I like the most, because they do have a lot of playmakers. Like you have LeBron, obviously you have Lonzo Ball, you have Brandon Ingram that can create. And obviously we're assuming they stay put and don't trade a bunch of those guys, but I think Hunter would be great there. Before you move on,
I am interested if the Pelicans end up picking with that fourth overall pick, in an Anthony Davis trade scenario, if the Lakers do move that pick, do you see them going in a different route than the Lakers would? Like, I'm interested to hear who you think the best pairing for Zion in the top four would be.
That's a really good question. You know, there's a lot of talk right now that RJ and Zion would be like the goal for them, which I would have some issues with, especially because the Pelicans
didn't look that good in college.
Yeah. And the Pelicans don't have a ton of shooters to put around them, because they would be taking their current roster, which doesn't have a lot of shooters, and putting a bunch of Lakers guys on it, which is not
ideal. And adding two guys that didn't shoot well in college in RJ.
Yikes.
Not great. You know, I think that the easy answer for me is like, I think it's Jarrett Culver, because I think that you're putting the two best like defensive people that are going to be in the top five realistically together. You're putting Culver and Zion together. You can play Culver as like a two next to like potentially Brandon Ingram, or you can play him as a three if you're kind of marrying yourself to Kyle Kuzma in that trade. Getting that positional versatility and also that kind of secondary playmaking and another guy who sees the court really well and is able to make the types of reads that Zion is going to thrive with in the NBA, I think is going to be really nice because, like, then you've got, you know, realistically, you're probably getting Lonzo Ball back in that trade. So you've got a primary ball handler. You've got Culver on the wing as kind of like a secondary guy. You've got Drew Holiday as another secondary guy. You've got a bunch of guys who can put Zion in a position to succeed. So, like, that I think would be a really optimal situation because you're getting the defensive value and then you're also getting, like, enough playmakers around Zion that you can make it work, even if it's not an optimal, like, spacing situation with shooters.
Yeah, I wouldn't hate Garland there. I think even Reddish would make some sense, which is something that was mentioned here in our Twitch feed.
Garland and Drew is like optimal for Garland. Like that's a great backcourt.
And I think it's good for Drew too. Like I think that works out really well. Our guy Lazarus Jackson, editor Detroit Bad Boys. Big shout out to him. He says having Beeline, does that make Reddish a little more palpable? Like, do you think that he would be able to maximize him a little more than other coaches? Or does that really not move the needle for what you think of him as a prospect?
I don't think that he moves the needle for me too much in terms of Reddish because, like, I think that Beeline's really good at putting guys into position to succeed. And I think that that's going to give Reddish, like, optimal offensive possessions. Like, I think that he'll recognize that, you know, using him as a floor spacer, but also giving him, like, transition opportunities and giving him, like, occasional ball handling opportunities is going to be good. But, like, I don't know that he's, like, the best prospect to kind of use that logic with. I think that to be in the offense that Michigan has run consistently, you need guys who make those quick decisions and can recognize when a defense is in a position that is kind of out off kilter and can move the ball to where the advantage is. That's kind of what his offense is based on. It's a lot like Utah's. So, like, I think that Reddish being, like, not the greatest decision maker in terms of the ability to make those quick reads kind of puts him in a negative position there. Like, that's something where I would much rather, you know, I would be much more excited about DeAndre Hunter in that capacity because, like, Beeline, I think, and his offense is really going to maximize Hunter's ability to read out of the pick and roll and be able to read off little simple actions and put his teammates in the right position to get easy buckets.
Bickerstaff with Hunter defensively, I think that would be something that would be really intriguing for me. You mentioned him a little bit earlier, and sorry to cut you off, but Nate Jacobson had asked in our Twitch feed what you thought of Coby White. He's a Bulls fan, wondering kind of his fit there at seven. Coby White's someone that I really like. I think that he can play next to ball dominant guys. Trevor, you had mentioned how you liked him even over Garland. Can you kind of explain some of the logic behind that?
Yeah, I think that he's just proven himself to be like a functional playmaker for a good offense. He's a guy who really kind of he's the best guy in the draft at the point guard position of marrying the two main roles of being a point guard, being a scorer and also being a facilitator for an overall offense. You know, he knew when to take a back seat when his shot wasn't falling or when the defense wasn't really presenting him with good opportunities. And he also recognized where his attacking spots were. And he kind of flipped between those two roles really well. He's one of the quickest guys in the draft, which I think is important. He's going to be a really good transition player, I think, at the next level, even though he didn't get a ton of those opportunities at North Carolina. And I think that he's just a guy who, you know, doesn't have, like, elite skills in the way that, like, John Morant's court vision or Garland's pull-up shooting are, but I think that he's good enough at everything that I think that he's got a reasonable chance of being, like, a very serviceable starter out of this class. And there aren't many guys you can say that about. So I think that that's one of my big draws to him is I would say there's probably less than 10 guys who I'm, like, confident are going to be, like, quality starters 3 years from now. And White's one of those guys.
Nice. I do want to, we don't have a ton of time left in the pod, but I do want to pivot over to Beeline because just as a byproduct of having watched so many Michigan guys, and we know you're one of the most thorough scouts in the draft space. Can you kind of give us just an overall primer on what to expect from Beeline offense and maybe some spots where you think he's going to excel and maybe some spots where you think, oh, he's going to have a tough learning curve?
Well, I think one of the biggest things to know about his offense is it's definitely something that works really well when he has multiple playmakers and multiple good decision makers on the floor. I think his offensive system and defensive system have been at their best when he has that. We look at his team this year. You had guys who were very limited in certain respects, particularly Xavier Simpson and Iggy Brazdeikis, both guys who, you know, had their moments and were quality players for the team, but definitely had big limitations. You know, Simpson, not a finisher, not really the greatest like one-on-one guy at the point guard position, but knew how to get his teammates in good spots. And then Brazdeikis couldn't create his own shot, but knew where to be in the offense to be able to capitalize off of Simpson and Jordan Poole. So like his offense was really predicated on kind of moving the ball side to side, getting the ball in multiple players' hands on a possession, and then kind of really capitalizing to where the defense is bent to be able to get a good finish, either from usually from three or getting a guy downhill towards the rim. So I think that that's one of the big advantages. I think that he's going to, on a team that is young and has a lot of guys who are kind of working on improving, I think that he's going to be able to put them in really good spots to be able to get them good experience and get them quality looks. And that's important. I think the main thing that he's going to struggle with is really kind of like I think that he's honestly going to struggle with what to do with Colin Sexton, because
I'm worried.
I think that he has had issues in the past with kind of figuring out how to optimally use primary creators. You know, he had a lot of success with Trey Burke, obviously, but then the next year, you know, Tim Hardaway Jr. was not used optimally as like a primary guy in the way that we've seen him in the NBA. He's got his limitations, but the guy can definitely create his own shot and really didn't get the greatest chance.
Especially against future enterprise rent-a-car salesmen,
exactly.
at Nebraska.
But you look again, Jordan Poole, another guy that he, you know, kind of struggled to put in optimal situations the last couple of years as like the primary guy. They relied a lot more on Simpson for like initial creation when Poole is probably the best like overall point guard on the team. So like I kind of worry about how he's going to work with Sexton's skill set, him not being like the best guy in terms of court vision, him not being the best guy in terms of decision making, but having a lot of talent for being able to create his own shot, and kind of wondering a little bit how that's going to work, throwing in Jordan Clarkson on that as well. You've just got a couple guys there that are prone to hijacking possessions, and I kind of wonder how he's going to account for that. And how he's going to work around that.
Especially since he can't just bench them. he has to play these guys. I do wonder, I mean, the thing that you do hear about Beeline's offense is that it is pretty ball screen heavy. And there were times where I got a little frustrated about, like, I just felt like the Cavs just needed to make Colin Sexton run pick and roll until he figured out how to make those reads. Is that something you kind of expect to see more of for him? Or is it kind of more of an equal opportunity, like everyone just kind of gets to use screens and, you know, whoever is feeling good gets to run the play?
I think it's going to be a little bit of both. I think that they're going to probably run him off pick and rolls on primary actions to initiate a set a lot more than we saw this year for Sexton. But I also think that there's going to be multiple opportunities within the same possession to get guys going. I think that one guy that I could really see benefiting from the way that that offense is structured is Jetty. I think that he's going to get a lot more opportunities off of primary sets where he's maybe getting play where there's a screen off ball. He's coming from the corner, dragging off a screen, catching from like a Sexton pick and roll, and then immediately going towards the basket as like maybe Kevin Love or Larry Nance flares to the three-point line to create space. That's going to be a set that I think that they're going to run a lot of, because that's how they used Brazdikas optimally this year. And they ran that with a lot of success. They ran that with a lot of success for Nick Stauskas in the past. So like that could be something that I could see Jetty really benefiting from, because that's what he did a lot in Europe too. Like they like to get him going towards the rim off of kind of like this flare and drag screens is like the second or third thing that the set that develops in the set once the defense is already moving. So like, I think that while Sexton probably is going to get a lot of chances in primary pick and roll, I think that it's going to benefit guys like Jetty, guys like Jordan Clarkson, who are going to be kind of like the second or third guy running those sets where there really wasn't that second or third set on a lot of possessions on the offense last year. I think that those are the guys who are going to look a lot better.
Yeah, I've heard quite a few people actually say that they think that Jetty's really going to benefit from this. And I think having a structured system that really is dependent on passing is going to be a good thing. Another thing that's really encouraging is that Colin Sexton, him flying in at 6 a.m. from the Philippines to get to the presser and to work out with Beeline right off the bat, I think that's really encouraging. I really, really like seeing that. And maybe having a structured offense where Beeline says, okay, this is what you need to do. These are the reads you need to make. If that's not there, go get your shot. I think especially having Bickerstaff there to help him kind of adjust to giving guys a little more freedom, I think that's going to be good. So maybe having things simplified and having a structured offense, especially with Sexton's work ethic and willingness to really dedicate himself, maybe that makes up for some of the natural vision that he's lacking.
Yeah, and I think that one of the other things that kind of helps with the transition from like college coach to NBA coach is one of the things that he's used to is giving the older guys who are more developed and have, you know, more clear idea of what they're doing, kind of letting those guys kind of free form and freelance more, and kind of really taking the guys who need the structure and being like, okay, we're going to do paint by numbers. Today you're going to run a high pick and roll and you're going to look for this read. Today you're going to come off of this screen and you're going to maybe get to dribble a couple times, but then you got to make a decision from where you get from that spot. You can't go all the way towards the rim. You can't, you know, pull the ball back out. Things like that. I think that that's going to be something that we might see. We might see a lot of Kevin Love early on. And then kind of like a slow progression of Sexton and then like maybe Jarrett Culver or, you know, hopefully RJ Barrett, like whoever the secondary guy is, whoever the secondary young guy is, just really kind of like ramping up what they do as the season goes on, as they get more confident and they get more, or he gets more confident in that they're going to actually do what the best decision is. A lot of that is how a lot of these successful development teams do kind of utilize their young guys, is you give them specific responsibilities when they're on the floor and you feed them and feed them and feed them more, as opposed to like just kind of letting them freeform whatever they want to do.
Yeah, that would be nice if the Cavs were a good young development team. We've never really seen that. I had one more question about Beeline before we go though. And are the Cavs going to play fast? We talked a lot about how they had the personnel to play a little faster than they have in the past this year, and they were 29th in pace. So is this a team that – is Beeline a guy who's willing to run?
I think that he could be. I think that he's one of those guys who I think is going to match. He does a good job of matching his roster. In terms of pace, like when Burke was their point guard, they ran a ton more than they did like the last couple of years when they didn't really have like, you know, this really fast creator who was best in the open floor as their primary ball handler. So I think that there's potential there. I think that he is going to probably recognize it. I think that he may be a little bit tentative towards running a little bit just because of the natural slower pace of the college game. He may not kind of – that may be an adjustment period for him, is kind of recognizing like what that's going to look like. That's why I want him coaching summer league, because, buddy, if you need an introduction to what NBA pace is like, here's 140 possessions of the worst basketball you've ever seen just to get you primed up there. So I think that that would be a real good learning spot for him, so he knows kind of what that high pace looks like, and he's not figuring that out, you know, once games are going and, you know, he runs into like the faster paced teams in the league right off the bat. Like, if he runs into the Hawks in the first 3 weeks of the season and he's still kind of adjusting to like college pace versus NBA pace, like that's not going to go well. So like, I really want him coaching summer league just for kind of like the exposure to what NBA pace is like and what he needs to adjust his offensive sets to actually kind of like function at that level.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I almost forgot that summer league is going to be coming up. We're less than a month away from the draft. That's exciting. And then we got summer league after that. We're going to get a little bit more of the sex, man. Looking forward to that. And whoever's on our team, we'll find out whether or not the Cavs are going to trade up, down, sideways, all over the place. Hey, who knows? Maybe they get rid of that Knicks terrible Kevin Knox contract and move up to three. So we'll see what's happening there. Trevor, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to all our followers on Twitch, everyone watching live, everybody in our Discord for submitting questions as well. Remember, if you want to stay up to date and find out when we're doing these broadcasts, you can do so by following at ChaseDownPod on Twitter, subscribing on Twitch, joining our Discord, which you can do by sending your review to chasedownpod@gmail.com. Support the show, support our sponsors, leave a rating, leave a review, subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe, cook those books. And until next time, go Cavs.
Love you guys.